Welcome to this special interview program that's part of a CME activity on PARP inhibitors and the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met via Zoom with each of the four faculty for this program, Drs. Katie Moore, Joyce Liu, Rob Coleman, and Stephanie LaRue, to further explore the data and their treatment practices. Interestingly, and perhaps a sign of how quickly things change in oncology, although I interviewed the four investigators over 10 days, between my first interview with Dr. Moore and the other three, there were two FDA approvals. So here's my chat with Dr. Moore, which focused on the use of maintenance PARP therapy after debulking surgery and postoperative chemotherapy. What I learned in this journey was there is a consistency in how the faculty saw the data, beginning with the issue of the appropriate genomic workup. So the first question is, what do you consider standard of care in terms of genomic testing for a patient who presents with ovarian cancer, no particular family history, in terms of what do you think is optimal, putting aside whether you're going to be able to access it for a doc in practice in terms of both germline and somatic testing?
So that's a great question. So standard of care is every patient with epithelial ovarian cancer should be offered germline testing for at least BRCA1 and 2, but really most of us have moved beyond that to the panel testing because there's other germline mutations, RAD51C, PALB2, BRIP1, that we want to know about as well because they impact selection of therapies to some extent, but really also impact familial counseling. So that is the standard of care. Now, patients may opt out of it, but that is the standard of care. For women who do not have a germline mutation, then I think the standard of care is to follow that up with somatic testing to look for at least tumor BRCA mutation, which is important. But we've already kind of moved beyond that. We need that. Plus, there's a number of other genes that we look at. These assays are becoming important in accessing care. The Quadra indication requires knowledge of an HRD test, for example. More will be coming. So at the very bare minimum, tumor testing for BRCA, but a panel test is likely better.
And why specifically? For example, do you miss things if you just do germline? Do you miss things if you just do somatic?
If you just do germline, now that we're testing more, we're getting better numbers of the actual prevalence of somatic BRCA mutations. So it looks like 7 to 10%. So if you only do germline testing, you're still catching the vast majority of patients. And so if we get to that point, I would be pretty happy. But you're missing 10% of patients. And across the board, if you look at, now we have frontline data, but we certainly had this in the platinum sensitive databases as well. Patients with somatic BRCA have the same hazard ratio for benefit from PARP as maintenance or PARP as treatment as germline BRCA mutation associated cancers. So from a purely predictive biomarker standpoint, it's very important to know because it could be transformative for your patient. So about 10% you'll miss. And if you said, well, I'm just going to tumor test everyone, I referenced the tumor BRCA testing in Paola, because if you have a germline mutation, it should show up in the tumor. And that's mostly true. In SOLO-1, we looked at that where we knew everyone had a germline mutation. And then we went and did the foundation testing to see how many of them would have a somatic BRCA mutation. We missed about 5% because they have large rearrangements or call frequency differences. There's different reasons why you would miss, but you miss about 5% of germ identification of germline patients potentially. And that's a big miss because of A, the implication for them getting a PARP, but also you miss the opportunity to prevent cancers in their first and second degree relatives, which is sort of the penultimate reward of testing, you know, making patients, family members not get the cancer that they have.
I'm curious about what you consider kind of standard of care for patients with BRCA germline mutations who present status post debulking in terms of your approach to chemotherapy, bevacizumab, and PARP inhibitors, both in an optimally debulked patient and suboptimally debulked?
Well, that's a great question. So for a patient with a known BRCA-associated cancer, the chemotherapy really is paclitaxel and carboplatin. There have been some, and I think some people really believe this, that intraperitoneal chemotherapy for those patients with no evidence of disease may be superior. And that's based on some exploratory studies that were done retrospectively. But we've never really borne that out. prospectively, I don't think it's wrong. I just think for me, they do very well with just every 21-day paclitaxel and carboplatin, and I have far less neutropenia than with dose dense, for example. So that tends to be my recommendation, you know, across the board for folks from a BRCA or not. Every 21-day paclitaxel carbo is what I use. Bevacizumab, I think, definitely has a role. There are patients who present with, you know, terrible ascites, or those patients who you said are suboptimal. I think we see less of those nowadays because of the use of laparoscopic staging. I think we've gotten a lot smarter about not opening someone and having to just close them back up. So we see a much more kind of trend towards neoadjuvant. And I think those patients benefit tremendously from the addition of bevacizumab because you see a more rapid and more deep response because of the synergy between paclitaxel and bevacizumab. And so I consider that for those patients, again, with or without a BRCA mutation. Pre-Paula, the question was, when you finished the six cycles and someone was in a great response, you know, then what do you do? Well, certainly you go to a PARP inhibitor. And the nice thing about Paula is that it shows just definitively that the bevacizumab is nowhere near equivalent to a PARP inhibitor in a BRCA population in terms of its efficacy. It's a great drug, don't get me wrong, but PARP is the standard of care. But pre-Paula, you're like, well, okay, now I have to stop the Bev. And that just seems uncomfortable because in the studies of bevacizumab, that group where you stop the Bev, they acted just like you hadn't given them Bev. And so people were uncomfortable with that. That's what I would have said you had to do if you couldn't continue both. Paula is now NCCN listed. And so for me, if I had someone on with a BRCA-associated cancer who was on Bev and chemo and they had a great response, I would continue the Bev and add in olaparib. That's what I would do. Debulking, residual disease, all that equivalent. This is, I would use the same thing.
Well, again, cost and reimbursement issues aside, you said olaparib, but why not niraparib?
Honestly, I think that the PARPs are very much equivalent in terms of efficacy. I truly do not believe there's a best PARP. They're all very effective, and the PARP you should use is the one you're most comfortable with. The NCCN goes by the data, and so the current data of maintenance, bevacizumab, and PARP in the front line is olaparib. But we have Avanova 2, which was, of course, a recurrent setting, platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, which was niraparib versus niraparib bevacizumab, and the combination looked better, and we have safety data. So reimbursement aside, do I think that's acceptable? Sure, absolutely.
What about the patient optimally debulked and, you know, no evidence of disease after debulking, for example? Or basically, how do you approach the patients who BRCA germline, but, you know, lower risk?
If I hadn't started bevacizumab, if I didn't think I needed it with the chemo and I was just using chemotherapy alone, then I would just go straight to a PARP as maintenance. That would be my preference.
Any preference in terms of which PARP?
No.
Niraparib or olaparib?
Niraparib or olaparib. Those are your two that are available right now in this setting.
Okay, yep. So the other question is, let's talk about the patient who is germline negative, HRD proficient, BRCA wild type patient. Again, higher risk, lower risk, how do you approach therapy?
This is the group of patients we need to design studies for. And this is the big clinical question. If you could get five of us in a room, you're going to get five different answers. So I think that one of the most interesting side notes from all these studies in parsing out patients by this particular biomarker is that we are learning that HRP, homologous recombination proficiency, identifies a group of patients who unfortunately have a poor prognosis. Across the board, and if you look at the placebo arms of all the studies, no matter how you defined HRP, their medians are very much shorter than the other groups. And that's not surprising, but we've just never looked at it before. So now we have this group of patients that we can identify as at risk. So we can say that. I don't think we can say what the best therapy for them right now is, to be perfectly honest. None of the studies that have been done put hypothesis testing on that particular subgroup. They were all exploratory, pre-specified, but exploratory subgroups. And so PRIMAs was positive, but Paula, you know, there was no difference, but they also had an active control. But does that really tell you anything about how to treat that population? I don't think it does. I think you have to look at the analytical subgroups that were defined in each of the studies, which is ITT. It included the homologous recombination proficient patients, and it was positive. And so what I would hope happens is that those studies get an all-comer indication, and then I, as a clinician, can talk to my patient about what I know and don't know about the efficacy and the risks, and she and I can decide what our plan of attack is for her very high-risk tumor. And that may include Bev plus PARP, or it may include Bev alone, or it may include PARP alone. Or she may opt to not do anything and just enjoy however much time she has off therapy at shared decision-making. But ultimately, I think it's going to be the FDA may limit that. We just don't know what they're going to say. So I don't think I can give you the right answer for that group, because we haven't proved it other than they're included in the all-comer analyses, and the all-comer analyses were positive. That's all we can say.
In that subgroup specifically, again, either niraparib or olaparib, or more towards niraparib?
I mean, I think either. I hope that both are options. You know, there's patients for whom bevacizumab is not an option for many reasons. There's patients for whom you cannot use bevacizumab. And I know now that those patients are going to do relatively poorly if I do nothing. And so I'd like to do something. And it looks like with PRIMA, at least, those patients benefit. I wouldn't say that I think niraparib is a better PARP for HRP. I don't think we can say that based on the data. PARPs, I think, are PARPs, and they have some differences. I hope both of them are available, but I would offer them to my patients if I were allowed to. One thing I think hopefully we can talk about in one of the future presentations, because it hasn't been presented at the virtual meeting yet, but the abstract has been released, so I can say a little bit, is the VELIA study, which we didn't talk about too much, but that's a very interesting trial where they gave avalimumab with chemo and to follow, and basically then compared it to chemo with placebo and placebo to follow. And that was also positive in all analytical subgroups. Liz Swisher did a very interesting analysis looking at HRD scores as a continuum and not a cut point of 42. And the predictive and prognostic value of HRD in that population. And the abstract says it's not predictive. So I'll stop there because I don't want to ruin her presentation, which is sort of jaw-dropping. But the HRD test is good, but if we're forced to go by that, which we might be, we're going to leave women behind who will benefit from a PARP. And that troubles me. And that's the HRP group. Like, you call them HRP, but we don't really know that they're HRP. They're HRP because their score was 40 instead of 42. And I don't know what that means. So it's a group we need to study.
I next met with Dr. Liu, again with the intent of figuring out how she approaches the initial management of ovarian cancer. But interestingly, in the interim, the FDA had now issued two new approvals. First, niraparib as maintenance therapy after chemotherapy, regardless of genomic status, and the combination of olaparib and bevacizumab in patients with BRCA germline mutations or HRD deficiency. But to begin my discussion with Dr. Liu, I repeated my first question to Dr. Moore, specifically asking her what she recommends in terms of genomic workup for the newly diagnosed patient with ovarian cancer and no significant family history.
So for somebody who presents with ovarian cancer, no family history. Optimally, I like to do germline panel testing, which is that if we think about it, BRCA1 and 2 mutations, absolutely 10 to 15% heritable mutations across the population, but also there are significant mutations outside of BRCA1 and 2, so BRIP1, RAD51CD, BARD1, PALB2, that are hereditary. And I don't want to miss those because of the potential for cascade testing and preventable disease amongst family members. Beyond that, I personally prefer panel testing within the tumor itself, so targeted next-gen sequencing, because I know that there's about a 5% rate of somatic BRCA1 or 2 mutations, and so I want to try and catch those for thinking about PARP inhibitor maintenance and guiding discussions with patients. But in addition, I think that having more information about the tumor is helpful. Recognizing that not everybody can get targeted next-gen sequencing information, I think at the minimum, you have to get germline panel testing. You have to get tumor BRCA1 and 2 mutation testing.
And am I correct in saying there are instances where a patient might have false negatives if you do NGS and if you do BRCA germline? Could you kind of explain where those come from?
Absolutely. So it's interesting because I actually recently had a patient who had a false negative tumor testing. And it has to do with what assays see and what they detect well. Some of it does have to do with different companies having different sort of thresholds for what they call a deleterious versus a not deleterious or VUS type mutation. But one of the things is a technical issue, which is that when we do targeted next-gen sequencing, which is how most tumor testing is done, the way the target next-gen sequencing is done, it may not detect moderate rearrangements, so large rearrangements or moderate-sized rearrangements. And when you actually do gene-specific testing, especially for BRCA1 and BRCA2, the way those assays have been developed, they've actually created more baits that will allow you to see rearrangements that happen, for example, in an exon. So in my particular patient's case, it turned out that she had a deletion in exon 3. So she had a deletion of exon 3 in BRCA1. And when we did her targeted next-gen sequencing, it turned out that it was not called because it could have been mistaken as an artifact because of the way those assays are interpreted. When we did her full testing and we sequenced specifically for BRCA1 and 2 and looked for mutations within that, there was a call that she had an exon 3 deletion, and we have the luxury of having an in-house next-gen sequencing platform. When I went back and spoke with our in-house folks and I said, oh, there was a call made about a deletion exon 3. Is this a real call or not? They were able to go back into our next-gen sequencing results and say, yes, we can see it, but we could not have called it because of the technical limitations of this platform.
Really interesting. So there are a couple other germline mutations that are seen, and I'm curious how you approach them.
So if they have one of these germline mutations, I bias towards giving them a PARP inhibitor. I think that with RAD51C and D mutations, I feel that the preponderance of evidence so far, with very limited numbers, suggests that those patients may have as much sensitivity to a PARP inhibitor as a patient with a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. I think that would be, you know, in terms of RAD51C and D, I feel that way about it. For PALB2 and ATM, I think the data are less clear. I don't feel that there are very strong data that say that these patients will respond to a PARP inhibitor the same way that a BRCA1 or 2 mutated tumor will. But that being said, I give these patients the benefit of a doubt because these are key players within DNA damage repair, but I am biased towards giving them the opportunity at a PARP inhibitor.
So another question I had is, I'm curious the way you were approaching genetic counseling in patients with no family history here you're sending for these kind of genomic assays, how you approached it a few months ago, and whether or not there's been any change in the way you approach it now.
Yeah, the biggest change, I think, for us, we have genetic counselors who speak with our patients. And the biggest change is that where previously our genetic counselors would come and see our patients when they were getting treatment, now they are getting separate telemedicine appointments and discussing it with our genetic counselors via telemedicine. Then they get their blood drawn when they come in for their treatment. I've actually recently also had a patient where, because of just sort of the timing of things, the genetic counselor actually sent them a saliva collection kit that they could do at home.
So in the last few days, we've seen a couple approvals in ovarian cancer. And first, I'd like you to go through what those approvals are, and then I'm going to ask you kind of how it's affecting your practice.
So the first approval, of course, was the approval for niraparib as maintenance therapy in frontline ovarian cancer that has responded to chemotherapy regardless of BRCA status and regardless of any other biomarker. So HRD status was not part of a limitation on the approval of niraparib. And then the second approval that just came through last week on Friday, I think, was the approval of the combination of olaparib together with bevacizumab in women who had responded to frontline platinum-based chemotherapy. But this one was limited to women who had tumors that were considered HR deficient by the Myriad assay as a companion diagnostic. So either they had to have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, or they had to have a Myriad genomic instability score of 42.
So a couple practical questions related to decision-making. First, I'm kind of curious in terms of choice of PARP inhibitor. Do you feel like you want to stick exactly with the data and the indications? In terms of choice, do you have any preference, for example, with a patient with a BRCA germline? Do you have any choice for a patient who's BRCA wild type, whether or not they have HRD?
I tend to try and stick within indications, although I'll be very honest, I think that I don't feel that there are significant differences between the PARP inhibitors in terms of efficacy between olaparib, niraparib, and rucaparib. I think veliparib, we know, is a slightly different PARP inhibitor. It can be combined with chemotherapy. It has different IC50s for PARP trapping as well as for PARP inhibition. And talazoparib is not approved in ovarian cancer currently. But I do tend to stay within the indications. I think that the choice of PARP inhibitor outside of that is dictated by the side effects. So, you know, for a patient who has a BRCA mutation where frontline or in recurrent setting where niraparib and olaparib are approved in the frontline setting, niraparib, olaparib, and rucaparib are approved in the maintenance setting. I do tend to use olaparib a little bit more often because my experience has been that it seems to have been more tolerable for many of my patients. I don't have to send them for the weekly blood work that I worry about with niraparib because I have had a few patients who have had profound thrombocytopenia. When I have the patients who are BRCA wild type in the frontline setting and I'm giving them a maintenance PARP inhibitor, I do tend to give them niraparib, but I tend to use the platelet and weight-based dosing.
So here's the real one, which is, how do you determine whether you're going to use a PARP inhibitor? And in particular, how do you determine whether you're going to use Bev?
I make my decisions about Bev based upon the clinical setting, which is that I tend not to use Bev in the frontline setting. I tend to limit it to only patients who have severe ascites or severe pleural effusions where I really need rapid control of their cancer. But otherwise, I don't tend to use bevacizumab, and the data from PRIMA and PALA have not changed my practice. I make a clinical decision about bevacizumab. In terms of who I think about to use for a maintenance PARP inhibitor, if they have a BRCA mutation, either tumor-based or germline, I recommend a maintenance PARP inhibitor for all of these patients. I think that although we don't have overall survival data yet, the degree of PFS benefit that we have seen is so profound that this is a not-to-be-missed opportunity. For patients who are BRCA wild type, I actually have a very long discussion with them about the relative risks and benefits that have been seen with a PARP inhibitor. There are some patients I've had who say, I don't care what you tell me, if it's going to give me even a little bit of time, I want to be on this drug. And for those patients, I prescribe them a PARP inhibitor and I don't do HRD testing. For some patients, they will say, well, if you tell me that I'm going to have a lot of benefit, I'll do it. But if it's 3 months, don't give me 3 years of a pill. Those are the patients where I will send HRD testing. And if their HRD test comes back with evidence that they have an HR deficient tumor, then we'll think about doing maintenance niraparib. If it's a HR proficient tumor, then I will defer and observe them. I think Bev has some degree of benefit. The degree of benefit was most in those patients who seem to have the highest risk stage 4 type disease or not debulkable stage 3 disease, if you look at the ICON 7 data. And those are the patients in whom I might consider Bev. PARP inhibitors, I think they, again, it's a numeric discussion. I think for somebody who has got a BRCA mutation and we don't have the OS data and we're not going to have it for some period of time, I think that there's a high likelihood, at least in my opinion, I feel that that will ultimately translate to overall survival benefit. And to say now that we're not going to give patients that because we don't know the OS benefit is really hard to do. But for patients who don't have a BRCA mutation, it's less clear to me that the degree of benefit that we're seeing is going to translate into overall survival benefit. And for some of these patients, they'll have opportunities at PARP inhibitors at a later date. They can get it in the relapse setting. I think that a lot of it comes down to that sort of what's the person's motivating factor? What is the importance of a small gain versus, you know, a larger gain and what they're willing to trade off for it? So if you have somebody who's young and they have three young kids and they're saying, I want every single day I can get without having to go back on chemotherapy, then I agree. That's somebody who is going to want to do a PARP inhibitor as a maintenance, regardless of what their any biomarker shows. I would still do their BRCA testing because I think it gives us a lot of information. And of course, I would do germline because I think that it is telling for their family. But I think that that's somebody where I would probably not, for example, think about HRD testing because she's already told me I'm going to do a PARP inhibitor regardless of an HRD test.
How about Bev though?
So here's the thing. It is not clear to me. And this is, I think, where this question of do you do Bev PARP or do you do PARP if you've got a newly diagnosed patient? It is not clear to me that Bev PARP gives you advantage over a PARP inhibitor alone.
Do you think that, you know, if a patient asks you who has, let's say, optimal debulking, they said, do you think I'll get any benefit out of Bev? What would you say?
I wouldn't recommend Bev to them.
Well, no, but I'm saying, would you get any benefit?
I think that you could get maybe some progression-free survival benefit, but you're not going to live longer because you did Bev. I make very firm recommendations when I think that there is likelihood that it's going to have an impact on survival. So you do chemotherapy after surgery, you do PARP inhibitor maintenance if you have a BRCA mutation. I do make firm recommendations about that. And for something like PARP inhibitor maintenance, if you don't have a BRCA mutation or do you do Bev, I'll say that personally, unless it was clinically indicated, I probably wouldn't do Bev. And in terms of a PARP inhibitor maintenance, I think that I personally would probably want to know what my HRD score was, but everybody's different.
I next met with Dr. Coleman, whose talk described the rationale and initial results of the phase 3 VILIA trial he led, evaluating the use of the PARP inhibitor veliparib during adjuvant chemotherapy and afterwards as maintenance. To begin, I asked Dr. Coleman about the clinical implications of these important data. Can you comment a little bit more about veliparib and the VILIA trial? I know you answered the survey saying that you thought it should be approved, and that certainly makes a lot of sense. It seems kind of like a similar alternative in certain situations to the existing approved agents. Can you describe a situation where you think you might prefer it over, let's say, olaparib or niraparib?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. Believe me, we have been going around and around and around in this in my circles. So if you think about a newly diagnosed patient, the information you have at that point is that they either have, you've chosen to undergo surgery and then you're going to plan for chemotherapy or you're going to plan for neoadjuvant chemotherapy after you get tissue biopsy. It takes about a week to get, you know, all of the genomic data back that you probably need with the exception of NHRD signal. So basically it comes down to, do you believe that it's of value to give concurrent treatment during chemo? That's kind of like the first decision tree. And if you're a yes, then it's, do you give Bev, or now if veliparib gets approved, do you give a PARP inhibitor? So you basically draw a line in the sand at that point. So what I've always felt that I try to give the most active agent as early as possible. I can't tell you based on the data that there's independent value to giving veliparib, but veliparib hasn't been studied as a pure maintenance strategy. So on cycle one, when you're writing your chemo orders, you're going to write Taxol carbo with or without Bev, or cycle two, with or without Bev, with or without veliparib, right? So you're going to make that decision right away. So I think that if you have a patient who's not a good candidate for bevacizumab, in which there are plenty, then, and you believe that exposure to a PARP inhibitor during chemotherapy is beneficial, and we've shown that it can increase the response rates, then that would be somebody I would consider giving it to.
You know, I was kind of flashing back when these debates that went on in breast cancer a long time ago, and the NSABP always gave endocrine therapy during chemo, and everybody else gave it after because theoretical, maybe some data, and it just sort of washed out that that's the way people did it. But one of their thoughts was, just like you said, I mean, for ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, you know, hormone therapy is much more effective than chemo, and they wanted to get it in fast. And that kind of sounds like what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, so one of the things that, you know, distinguishes veliparib from all the other, or the VILIA from all the other trials, is that all the other trials require a response. So you have to give something, you have to have a response. And then at that point, you can then have your menu. When you analyze the data from Velia, you don't have to have that predicate. It's just that you started it with treatment and your opportunity was then to continue it during therapy if they didn't progress.
I say that I never really understood why you all say response to chemotherapy when it's after surgery. To me, I always interpret it as they didn't progress, not that they responded. Does that sound more, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. So, and you remember now that we've pivoted to more neoadjuvant, you know, in recent years, the response to chemotherapy, you could measure it on the induction phase before you even took the patient to the OR. So that's one kind of element. But you're absolutely right. With our focus on doing good surgery, either primarily or after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, the patients that are finishing up their chemotherapy are finishing up with no measurable disease to begin with. So you're right.
So I want to track through. We were asking all the faculty kind of what they're doing. You mentioned the two new approvals that came out in the last couple of weeks, niraparib, now PARP on the table for everybody, and then the bev/olaparib approval, which is really interesting, and I want to kind of get into. I really want to dissect that out in terms of what you're doing. But just to begin, it sounds like you're using some type of HRD measurement. I'm guessing the Myriad one, or what do you use?
Yeah, for all the trials, especially the ones that I've run, the trials have used the Myriad MyChoice. The predominant use of that is, you know, using the 42 cutoff, but that was not used in the Velia trial. And I don't know if you saw, we presented last week that there was really no relationship between the cutoff and response to the triplet.
Yeah, that was at the SGO meeting. I was going to ask you about it. Let me ask you, though, for a gynecologic oncologist in the community or medical oncologist community, do you think they should be ordering some type of HRD measurement?
Yeah, so that's, oh man, now you're trying to get into my politics. I'm actually quite upset about the FDA's decision. I'm going to try to make that known in public, too. But we can talk about that. But I do think that, you know,
I can see it in your answers. I already see it in your answers, right? I mean, when we asked you, you know, we forgot to put in the poll, do you think you should order HRD? We just said, what do you do?
Yeah, right.
And I see right in your survey that you're using it to make decisions. So you're not using PARP in people who are HRD proficient BRCA wild type, right?
Yeah, I have to admit, I know I'm out there, but I'm a purist here. And I go back to the biology. I think that the activity that we've seen with PARP in HR proficient patients is more linked to the poor performance of the test that's actually allocating HRD versus HRP than its actual activity. And I think that in those true HRP patients that we shouldn't be wasting our time with PARP inhibitors, we should be looking at something else. And certainly Bev is one of those options that's on the table. But I think the question you asked is whether or not we should be doing HRP testing or HRD testing. And I think that, you know, now that it appears, you know, for the community oncologist, now that it appears in the NCCN guidelines, and they're using it to basically allocate treatment to either niraparib or olaparib, and now with the approval linked to it, that people that are interested in giving bevacizumab and olaparib, that they would want to have that data. And so it really gets down to, again, as I mentioned, you make that decision to give chemotherapy plus bev right at the beginning. And so to be able to add the olaparib, you would want to have the HRD testing.
So I kind of want to get into that a little bit, but just getting back to Velia again, you know, from 10,000 feet, which is how I see everything along with everybody else out there in the community, we're hearing everybody say different things, but it kind of seems like the data for the Velia study is pretty similar through indirect comparison to what's been seen with the two approved agents. And it sounds like you have a choice if it gets approved between one strategy versus the other. I'm just trying to think it through from the point of view of the doc in practice in terms of this issue of giving a chemotherapy plus the veliparib. In general, you know, you would think it might be a little bit more complicated. Toxicity one might affect the other one, cytopenias, whatever. Clinically, it makes it a little bit more complicated on paper. But what I want to ask you, since you've had so many people go through it, is it really essentially the same as taking care of somebody getting chemo?
So that's a good question. I would say that when we first started this program, which was many years ago, it was more problematic, mostly because we really didn't understand how to deal with PARP toxicity. But this has been less problematic than I would have imagined had we used a drug like olaparib. The trial was, I thought, well built for dose modifications. And since we had full dose chemotherapy, we had a lot of leeway to actually customize the chemotherapy to the reduced dose of the olaparib. Remember, it was quite a bit reduced. The other lesson we learned in the trial was that if you think about the other maintenance trials, they were all built in with like an 8 to 12 week window where they could be registered. In Velia, you know, course 7 was 3 weeks after course 6. And so if they were on a PARP inhibitor during that course number 6, when they went into full dose PARP on course number 7, we started seeing more adverse events. And that just goes to show you what the impact of full dose PARP will do with lingering effects of chemotherapy. So what we decided to do early on in the trial was to have a step up. So 2 weeks at a reduced dose, 2 weeks later at the full dose. And that mitigated a lot of that difficulty in the administration.
Well, we know clinically, and even your data there on the tolerability issues, that you see GI problems and cytopenias. And again, with chemo kind of causing the same problems, it sounds like it might be a little more challenging. But we'll see whether we even have the opportunity to do it in terms of the FDA.
Yeah, that's going to be the preliminary.
The real question I want to ask you, I'm asking all the faculty, is a real simple question that I think a lot of people in practice have, which is, you have a patient with ovarian cancer, their status post-debulking surgery, and yeah, we can look at, you know, what their risk is, whether it's optimal debulking or not. We can look at what their BRCA status is, anywhere from BRCA germline all the way down to HR proficient, BRCA wild type. But how do you decide whether to get, it sounds like putting Veli aside, you have the choice of giving chemo Bev followed by Bev, or chemo Bev followed by Bev olaparib, or chemo followed by olaparib or niraparib. And I guess my question is, how do you make that decision?
I'll add one more. So if you actually look at the label for olaparib bevacizumab, there's no indication that you need to be on chemo Bev. So it's just approved for patients who are following chemotherapy. So you could give chemo followed by Bev olaparib on label. So that would be the other in that process. You had 6 different types of situations that could happen. So what am I going to do?
So just tell me, how do you decide whether you're going to use Bev?
Yeah.
And how do you decide whether you're going to use a PARP inhibitor? Let's not even talk about which PARP inhibitor.
Yeah.
How do you decide whether you use Bev and or PARP?
Right. I think that, and I think a lot of my colleagues agree with this, is that the patients that have ascites that are symptomatic, they're more apt to want to use Bev in that population. Not so much that they're quote unquote high risk, but that the ability to achieve a response is relatively enhanced and quicker when you add those two. And I think that that's a reasonable strategy. The rest of the, you know, kind of where I'm going to use a PARP or not is really going to be focused on that biomarker testing. And like I said, I'm a little bit of a purist here. So we'll have, you know, the HRD and BRCA status while those patients are getting treatment. And so if I've started Bev because of side effects in the HRD patient population, I would add the olaparib. If they're wild type, I'm going to continue Bev.
My question is, who do you use Bev in?
Those patients that, you know, like I said, that need a response, ascites.
So in other words, suboptimal debulking, no Bev?
Oh, suboptimal debulking, I think, is a good case for Bev. Yeah, outside the surgical window. But I also think the patients who have, you know, ascites with an optimal resection would be a good candidate for Bev. The patients that aren't are ones that have limited tumor volume, which aren't that many, obviously earlier stage disease, you know, people that have risk factors for wanting to use it. So poorly controlled hypertensive, patients with inflammatory bowel disease, you know, bowel involvement, all the usual, all the same things that we've used for years with the incorporation of Bev. So my choice is that if I've made the decision to give Bev, then I'm going to be making my decision to give a PARP based on the outcomes of the biomarker testing. Solo 1 is one of the very few examples where at multiple years, the curves are still split. So they have retained what we call proportionality. The hazards are proportional and are across the entire spectrum. This is not the case for Bev. So Bev, it violates the proportional hazards model. So I'm hopeful that we will see more cures.
The final faculty member I met with was Dr. LaRue, And to begin, I asked her about the data just presented at the ASCO meeting of the SOLO 2 trial that has now demonstrated a survival advantage for the use of maintenance olaparib after platinum-containing chemotherapy in patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent disease and a BRCA germline mutation.
For me, having seen the SOLO 2 overall survival is quite impressive, because I think when the initial PARP inhibitor went in, there were a lot of discussion about, is it true benefit? Because it was only PFS at the beginning. And people were worried about, oh, but it means the disease will be so resistant after that actually they may die more quicker than we thought. So I think it's why after they tried to develop this secondary endpoint in terms of PFS2, OTTS test 2, to try to really try to see if the trend was keeping after the PFS. But I think it was still remaining in the mind of people saying, like, you know, if you re-challenge with platinum, do you really have the same or not? And because there was this fear that maybe you increase the risk of resistance of the cancer. And I think to have this overall survival data, I think it's so reassuring. And I think it's the first time that we saw that in a way in cancer with a targeting therapy. So I think it's very impressive. And to have also the fact that, like, at 5 years, we're talking about platinum sensitive recurrence. So they have 5 years, more than a half, still alive. And usually when we talk about ovarian cancer, we say that overall survival is poor, and we usually take the cutoff for 5 years. And actually here, past the 5 years. But we cannot forget that SOLO2 is focusing on the BRCA. And we know from all the PARP that the group that benefits the most is the BRCA. So I think it's very good to see overall survival. And I think from the SOLO1, I hope we will have the same. Because when we look at the SOLO 1, we have this kind of plateau at 2-3 years. So I hope that we translate into overall survival. I hope, given the result of the SOLO 2. We will see that with the beyond BRCA. That is the main question. Probably, you know, the HRD positive. But again, the HRD positive is not a test that take all the patients together, and there is some limitation. And as I say, it was done each time on the archival tissue. And when we know that the tumor can change, that is a limitation. So I think it will be not as impressive, I think, in the HRD. But I think given the HRD group was really identified as a group having benefit, I think we may see like benefit, but I think that will be not as impressive probably as BRCA.
So also, you know, as it relates to that question in terms of, you know, advanced stage disease, I'm kind of curious, when you see a patient with both platinum sensitive and platinum resistant disease who's never had a PARP inhibitor, first of all, how do you decide whether or not you're going to use it and which one?
So it depends. At the time of platinum sensitive, I'm very biased because I'm from Canada. So I will go with a regulation and what is covered. I will go in Canada based on our approval for the BRCA population with olaparib, because it's BRCA approved for olaparib. If there are non-BRCA, we recently have a specific access program for niraparib access. So if there are platinum sensitive responding non-BRCA, I will go with niraparib. But that is because of the regulation of our system. In terms of if I would be in a country or in a setting where I can choose between the three, I think I will use one where I'm more comfortable with. And I think I will also discuss that with a patient. Because, for example, if a patient have a lot of nausea and are very sensitive to nausea, olaparib is probably the one who gives a little bit more nausea than niraparib. But niraparib has a lot of potential hematological toxicity. But then if we can use a dose modification based on the weight, and if she didn't have any hematological problem toxicity in the past, you know, it's how we can guide. Rucaparib as well, I think, is relatively similar to rucaparib. The only thing is this liver enzyme, but I think it's well tolerated as well. So I really go with the one that I feel comfortable and based on the patient as well. Because if the patient has the tendency to forget to take the pills again once daily, it's easier than twice daily.
What about the issue of using a PARP inhibitor in a patient who had one previously? Just sort of putting aside regulatory issues in terms of kind of clinical risk benefit, in terms of whether or not that's worth doing. Any thoughts about that?
So currently, you're right, it's not approved. And currently, we do not know what is the benefit? So it's why there's a trial ongoing, the OREO trial, that hopefully will give us an answer. So I think we don't know yet if there is a benefit of rechallenge or not. I think Dr. Moore presented that SGO last year, potential benefit for some patients with rechallenge was a small retrospective study. But I think what would be probably important is how the first PARP was used for. So if it was, you know, in the first line setting and this, it has been stopped after 2 years or 3 years, according to the regulation, and then after the patient relapsed and still platinum sensitive, still responding, I think, you know, spontaneously, I will discuss, but you're right, there is no data, and I don't know if the benefit will remain because of the 12-hour part naive. So we don't know, but I think it's something that would be interesting to assess. The patient who actually were on platinum-sensitive recurrence have a PARP inhibitor treatment and then progress within 8 months. I think here the benefit of rechallenge is probably not high, but it's where the benefit will be eventually to rechallenge, but with something else. So it's why now we have all this trial that where we look at eventually combining with PARP with something else to try to overcome this resistance. And that would be probably more the way to go rather than to rechallenge with a PARP monotherapy. Probably rechallenge with a PARP, but with combination of something.
So I want to talk a little bit more with you about your experience with using PARP inhibitors in terms of tolerability issues and toxicity issues. You were talking about the GI problems that are seen with these drugs, and you mentioned olaparib. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you see this playing out in your patients, how you approach it? Do you use preemptive medication, for example?
So as we know, because it's a chronic use, I think it's very important to make sure that the patient will take it because we have much less control compared to an infusion. It's every 3 weeks. So I think set up the expectation with the patient will be very important, and to be honest with them, that we know that they may experience some GI toxicity. And I usually prescribe preemptively some anti-emetics drug, specifically because we know that the initial side effects appear during the first 2 months specifically. So yes, I usually prescribe preemptive anti-emetics to my patient. I also advise them sometimes to take a little bit of snack with it. The type of snack really depends on the patient. So the tastes are very different and that really depends. But I think it's very important to educate our patient and also to try to explain to them why we're doing it. So it's why, again, going back to the trial and what has been observed, knowing that, yes, it's not necessarily what happened to them, but actually showing that the benefit that has been seen may help them to try to continue to be on treatment. Because sometimes the perception is very different from these pills compared to the chemotherapy, for example. So I think the education of the patient is important. I think it's also important to follow them on a regular basis because it's a pills and then we don't necessarily need to see them all the time. But I think to keep in touch with them regularly, I think it's important.
Initially, I was hearing people talk about, you know, like, again, GI problems with olaparib, platelet problems with niraparib, and cytopenias. But do you think that all these agents have some degree of cytopenia, some degree of GI, and it's kind of just, or is it more black and white?
It's a class effect. So they will all have similar, like they will all have hematological toxicity and GI because it's a class effect. But then after, because they have a slightly different affinity and maybe some off-target activity as well that we completely don't know all about, we may have slightly different side effects. But for example, niraparib also has some hypertension that has been observed as well. So I think it's something that we need to mention as well to the patient because it's something that I mentioned to them because I have started some antihypertensive medication to some of my patients on niraparib.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for the special interview program to a CME activity on PARP inhibitors in the management of ovarian cancer.